Welcome to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, and from Indy Todd. George Bernard Shaw was an Irish-born writer based in London who is perhaps best known for his plays at the turn of the last century. But he was also a journalist who at times was sharply critical of the way the press covered major world events. And at the dawn of World War I, he risked his career by challenging the British government. Many of his insights and critiques ring true today in a rapidly changing news environment where sensational headlines and social media posts rule the hour. With me this morning is Nelson Richel, author of Bernard Shaw, W.T. Stead, and The New Journalism. Richel is head of the Humanities Department at the Massachusetts Maritime Academy. Good morning, Nelson. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Shaw might be best known as a playwright, but he started his career as a journalist, and he was a prolific writer throughout his life. Talk a little bit about who Shaw was. Irish first, and then British second, in a way.
Absolutely, yes. Shaw was born in Dublin in 1856. He emigrated to London in 1876, at 20 years old. And like many that would leave Ireland at that time, he went for work. And he reached London at a very, very interesting time, particularly if we looked at what was happening in journalism, not just in England, but throughout the Western world, certainly in the United States. What had happened in the 19th century, early into the mid, was a growing fascination with crime. Mm. And we get into a lot of court cases that are their trials, testimony recorded word for word in newspapers. And this starts to create a sort of a almost a cult. If there was a very sensational murder, people would travel great distances to see where the event took place, even collect little souvenirs. And by mid-century, this starts to become great coverage of such crimes. It was expanding. And also by that time, we start to get greater levels of literacy than the world had ever had before. And that, of course, promoted more newspapers. Mm. And for a city like London, and most cities at the time, there would be morning papers, evening papers, and of course, aimed at various different levels or class levels. And the more we got to the end of the 19th century, there were papers popping up that were specifically aiming for a working class or a lower middle class. Of course, that brought in a greater sense of democracy. More people thought they had a voice. They could read this material, think for themselves. And by the time we get to the 1880s, there becomes a development that is now known as the new journalism. Mm-hmm. This starts to develop in England, but also in the United States. And one of the things physically that happens in newspapers is we suddenly get headings and subheadings. We no longer have one font, where it was before, the newspapers were just simply columns of the same font throughout, no headings or very little. And now we had subheadings, we had changing fonts, so the papers looked different, and there was more space. And then what gradually happened, instead of just pure reporting word for word what was happening in trials, we started to get summaries of what was happening. And then as that started to go, newspapers started to become a little more, a little flamboyant in it. And it's also the period when the detective literature emerges. It's also the century, in this part of the century, when modern police forces in cities around the world, or Western world for sure, are established. So it becomes a greater sense of dealing with crime, but also in dealing with policing. And the new journalism would fall into that.
So George Bernard Shaw was coming of age in all this time of rapid change, and it prompted him to join the Fabian Society. Talk about that.
In 1884, Shaw joined the Fabian Society in London. And the Fabian Society was a socialist organization, and they had a unique philosophy. And their sense of, and this is probably really greatly simplifying it, but what their view was that they would see that the changing of society would be a gradual process, that they would educate society over time. And Shaw was very much a part of that, but he also could see the value of journalism in this regard. And he had friends who were journalists, and they started to attract him, and he started getting various positions with newspapers. And Also,
I think it's interesting to mention that with this viewpoint, I mean, Shaw's coming of age at a time where there's a lot of changes, as you said. The newspaper industry is evolving and starting to sound more of like what we see today. But we've got the Industrial Revolution, and you've got a lot of political upheaval where you have people who are much more radical and want change much more quickly. And so for Shaw to have this kind of gradualist mindset, as we're going to learn, it really kind of influences his later work.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's a very good point. In the 1880s, we have anarchists that are demanding change right away. There's Irish revolutionaries in London following both the Irish revolutionaries and the anarchists are following bombing campaigns. So it is a very, very volatile situation. And then parliamentary efforts were going toward to creating greater suffrage among the voters.
And so this view, this Fabian view, really kind of influences Shaw. But he's a writer. He wants to make a mark of some sort.
Yes. In 1885, he's hired onto the Pall Mall Gazette, where basically he's a reviewer and reviewing popular novels. And most of these novels were not of literary value, and most of them are forgotten today. But when he's on the Pall Mall Gazette, and this had a new editor came to the fore, and this was a fellow named W.T. Stead. And Stead became an extremely important figure for this period. And in 1884, Stead launched a series of articles which he called The Truth About the Navy. And his effort in these articles in this series was to counter the prime minister at the time, William Gladstone, was trying to cut the Navy budget. He was trying to trim it down. And Stead took issue with that, and he started to talk about other European countries, where they were in their naval expenditures. And in fact, this was the very period where the arms race that would eventually lead to the First World War was starting. And through Stead's articles, Gladstone had to change his approach, and the government backed away from cutting the naval expenditure, and in fact, they increased it. What Shaw would have seen, or someone of his persuasion, that Stead's articles had taken journalism and made a forced the government into a change. It was a phenomenal idea.
So this was a new thing?
Oh, absolutely, yes. To make that kind of a direct change and fairly quickly. So even though Shaw's looking at this Fabian idea of gradually over time, here Stead delivered almost an immediate result. The following year, in 1885, which is when Shaw joins the Pall Mall Gazette, in the summer, Stead unleashes a series of articles that he identifies as the tribute to modern Babylon. Mm-hmm. And these articles, they start off as bringing an attention to childhood prostitution that was happening in London. And Stead followed a young woman, or a 12-year-old girl. The first article follows that she is purchased from her mother. She's taken to a medical physician who inspects virginity. Then she's taken to a brothel where she is sold to the brothel procuress. And this is
kind of like investigative reporting.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Indeed it was. Yeah, absolutely. And so this was suddenly a phenomenal development. And it created, of course, great outrage. This idea that, you know, this type of prostitution was happening. A very famous editor who would become famous in a few years, Frank Harris, who was in another paper, he took issue with this. And he said, well, this kind of thing shouldn't even be mentioned. And of course, indeed, it never was mentioned before.
Because it wasn't proper?
It wasn't proper. And there was, I think, the society would have, you know, would have really at the time preferred not to think of such things. And Harris, he would question whether something like this even existed outside the putrid mind of Stead. What happened with Stead was that the purchase of this young girl was staged.
Ah.
And this becomes what happens is reporters from another newspaper with the child's mother and police, they've tried to find out, investigate where did she go? And it is discovered she's in domestic service in France. And what had happened was through connections in the Salvation Army that Stead had, they did purchase this young girl, but they did not take her to a procuress. It was supposedly someone who had been reformed, but it was essentially a staged event, mm-hmm. or as Shaw would call, a put-up job. And for Shaw, he would say later on, we never trusted him again.
I would imagine that at a time like that, certainly this investigative journalism, so this is a new field, and you see this in America too. You see some journalists going undercover into insane asylums and stretching the boundaries of what in modern day journalism we would consider to be highly inappropriate. But I do find it interesting that Shaw looks at Stead and kind of almost looks at him as an adversary, right?
Oh, yes. And yet it also is someone that's, it's almost as if he monitors him and to see what is Stead doing now. And Stead would frequently try to contact Shaw, and Shaw would also at times contact Stead. Part of that, if we go just back to that Babylon series, the whole series that would be run would also force the British Parliament into an act that would raise the age of consent. And this was an act that had been in the Parliament for 2 years, lingering around, not getting to a vote, and instead clearly had the effect of bringing Parliament into action once again. So there was that aspect to Stead. So Stead was demonstrating how journalism could have a direct impact.
Could be really a tool for change, not just a way to inform people on daily events.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
And that itself is momentous, although, as we're saying, Shaw really saw the limits of stretching the truth. And we talk a lot about that, I think, in today's world, where we're looking at alternative facts. And
yes, and that certainly Stead goes down that direction and blazes a trail of, say, shock journalism. But it is, he does push the limits and does alter facts.
What were Stead's motives, do you believe? Do you think that they were pure? Do you think it was because he wanted to affect social change? Or was he looking for kind of the big story and that big headline and some name recognition?
Probably a bit of all of that. I think he truly believed in his convictions. He really felt he was doing good for society. And you know, if we looked at that Babylon series again, well, yes, he did bring a greater awareness of prostitution as a problem in society, not just, you know, and of course, Stead saw it as a moral issue, but Stead also, the deeper he got into shock and sensational journalism, the deeper he got into popularity, and he becomes addicted to it, seduced by his own popularity, and he keeps trying to strive to get back to it. And he would find different ways. He's frequently in this period from 1884 to 1890 as the editor of the Pall Mall Gazette, where he's is sued for libel a number of times. And after each one, he's always trying to repair his standing with the paper's publisher. So to do that, he has to push his popularity again. And to find that popularity is through those sensational stories.
And then on the other hand, we've got Bernard Shaw, who's a foil in so many ways and kind of trying to go down this more rational path. And even with this tribute to modern Babylon, Shaw takes some issue with the notion that people focused more on the scandalous nature of the story and the fact that it talked about prostitution and maybe ignored some of what he saw as some deep social issues that drove people into prostitution in the first place.
Yes, absolutely. And Shaw was very concerned with the economics and the poverty. The poverty was staggering, and the attention that Stead brought to prostitution, part of it was a fascination with it, part of it was an abhorrence against it. But the reactions that were of those who were outraged by it tended to be, well, this is a moral issue, and they would not really see it as, let's dealing with the economic situation on political terms, but let's see if we can raise the morality of these folks. And instead of recognizing the economic factors that would lead, you know, a lot of people that went into prostitution at the time, in Shaw's view, did so because they were either unemployed, habitually unemployed, or they were paid with such meager wages as he would say, to keep body and soul together, they had to do it. And instead leads folks towards a sense of that those in prostitution lacked morality.
Moral outrage.
Yes, and it becomes moral outrage, and that for Shaw was outrageous.
It reminds me a little of Stead capitalizing, as you talked about, that the turn of the century there, or the years leading up to it, you know, fascination in crime stories and detective novels. And there's a similar kind of interest today. We have, in a way, reality TV, where there's a lot of that kind of, you're watching something almost like, just watching like a train wreck, in a sense. Stead was capitalizing on it when Shaw's over here saying, wait a minute, there are bigger issues at play.
Absolutely. And even Stead was cognizant of this. He would, in the summer of 1888, he wrote an article where he talked about this. And he said, well, you know, what we're getting to is a first-class murder will get us more readers than the finest prose ever written.
And if it bleeds, it leads.
And that's essentially the same phrase. Absolutely.
You know, some of these issues, really, it's the format might have changed, but yeah, certainly the draw and
absolutely. And
has not.
While Stead writes this, this is at the very time that the Whitechapel murders start to happen, and mm-hmm. Stead's paper, with Stead firmly in the helm, goes down that path of sensationalizing.
Right, and that's Whitechapel, a bunch of grisly, grisly murders. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about Stead and George Bernard Shaw's journalism at the turn of the last century. You're listening to The Point. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, and for Mindy Todd. My guest is author and scholar Nelson Richel. He wrote a new book on George Bernard Shaw that focuses exclusively on his journalism. Before the break, we were talking about world events that influenced Shaw. But I want to turn now to his methods, especially in comparison to editor W.T. Stead, because Stead was the editor of a newspaper, but Shaw wrote letters. Was that usual for the time?
Well, for example, Shaw was hired by the Star newspaper, which had opened in January 1888, and he was hired to be a political writer. And within a few weeks, he resigns because he feels that his political commentary is being edited by the editor, who was very pro the Liberal Party at the time and wanted Shaw just to attack the Conservative Party, and Shaw was attacking both parties. So Shaw offered his resignation, yet when he came in to resign, it was worked out that he would continue to submit paragraphs. So while a lot of times he writes letters and they come into the newspaper and they appear as a letter to the editor, and particularly in our way of looking at it today.
Why would it go in as a letter versus just an article? Is it because he was offering analysis and insight at a time when most of the articles that you would see in a paper were kind of using reporting and slowly evolving a little bit of a narrative edge to them, it sounds like?
Yes, absolutely. And Shaw was, he had a greater leniency and greater freedom by sending him in his letters. And sometimes he would send in letters not in his name. And as he got older, the more and more he would use his name. And if he didn't sign it, whatever those paragraphs were going to say, the editor stole his thunder. So as he started to see himself evolving into this an important writer, he realized that he had to have his name on it.
And it really shows, too, this evolution in the field of journalism today. Of course, we think of, as much as humanly possible, you want a name on something, whether it be the person who created the piece, whether it be a person you talk to, and there's so much talk these days of anonymous sources in today's news. But you look back at the time where Shaw was writing, and it really was kind of a Wild West, where until someone hit a wall, like Stead did, getting sued for libel, anything kind of went, as if it would sell a newspaper. It kind of reminds me, too, of somewhat of the Twitter sphere or even blogging, where you can kind of get online, say what you want. There's anonymity there. There isn't a lot of etiquette there.
Yeah, there's no fact-checking.
Yeah.
And that allows all sorts of things to get out, and mischief more often than not.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that struck me about Shaw was there were times when he used his role in British politics as an outsider because he was Irish-born.
Oh, yes. Yes, he would frequently see himself, he would call himself, as a missionary in this most distressful country. And so Shaw always worked very hard to maintain his Irish identity and never lost his brogue, probably consciously never lost his brogue, I would think.
So if you're going to cultivate the outsider image, yeah, then that brogue is going to help build that kind of cultural wall. Do you think that helped when he was offering some insight and criticism? I mean, he levied a lot of criticism against folks like Stead, who were out at the edge of journalism in that shock journalism, almost yellow journalism area.
I think absolutely, and particularly when he got older. By the time of the First World War, yes, he's very consciously using that, even refers to it directly. And Shaw would have also, in his own view, see that because of that detachment, he could be more objective. Mm. And I think he really saw that. And it wasn't as, so if he was English and really steeped in everything that was happening, and of course he was invested in what was happening, but he could see that as an outsider, whether it's a cultivated outsider, because there were a lot of Irish and other nationalities in cosmopolitan London in the late 19th century into the 20th century. But Shaw would have seen that his identity was important as this outside observer, and he could make his objective comments. So one of the things that Shaw was very focused on in his journalism, which would lead into his plays as well, was the truth. And Shaw would have seen and did see the shock journalism that Stead had pioneered, that so many disciples followed Stead, because Stead had such great success. All kinds of journalists followed him, editors, newspapers. They would follow that model beyond Stead's death. And Shaw would, when there was important issues that were being debated or needed to be debated, we were not getting objective views, and society could not have an intelligent consideration or contemplation of what was happening. Hmm. And Shaw believed that that was the essence of democracy. We have to be able to know what's happening and decide for ourselves. Hmm. And then the proper form of journalism, in Shaw's view, should give us that information so we can make those intelligent decisions on our own.
Something that still stands today and again has been the subject of so much conversation, especially in the aftermath of the last election, with the role of journalism and the rise of what some people believe to be biased news outlets and one outlet against the other outlet and, mm-hmm. You know, outlets competing for, the most sensational headline in regards to maybe what the president has done today or something to that effect. Yes.
And we get that whole notion of fake news. Mm-hmm. And the fake news, it's the same. It's the same animal that Stead had pioneered and other journalists had followed.
Yep. I want to turn and take a look, jump ahead a few years to the Titanic.
Ah.
You know, it was an event that rocked not only Britain, but also the U.S. at the time. That was when the Titanic sank after hitting an iceberg and more than 1,000 people died. And Shaw, I found reading about this in your book especially interesting with Shaw's reaction. Now, we're talking about sensationalism and really getting to people's emotional core. And I feel that this world event really highlights that kind of journalism. And Shaw really put his hand out to say, stop, we're not looking at the right issues.
Yes. When news came of the ship sinking, which was fairly quickly, wire communications was picked up. But before the survivors had reached New York, before there was a real understanding of how many people perished on the ship or what had happened on the ship, the newspapers and both sides of the Atlantic were desperate for news. And in Shaw's view, and I think in any objective view, a lot of newspapers and journalists fabricated what had happened. And they started to make certain figures into romantic heroes, whether they deserved that or not. And for example, one point that Shaw took great issue with was the way the captain of the Titanic, Edward Smith, was viewed and was portrayed. And Shaw was taken by these various stories that would come out, and he would say that they're treating him as if he was Lord Nelson and a great naval hero of Trafalgar. As evidence started to come in and it would drift in through newspapers, yet not really focused on by newspapers. And some of that was that Smith had received warnings from ships ahead of the Titanic, that he was heading for an ice field. But the ship stayed on course, stayed at 22 knots with no regard to the ice. Now, of course, Stead was of the view that the ship was of a modern design and it could sustain icebergs.
Sure, it was the unsinkable ship.
It was the unsinkable ship. So, and he, no doubt, he believed that as well. But what Shaw's point was that his actions were questionable. And then
The captain's actions,
yes. Yeah. And we got deeper into the tragedy. The reality seems to be that Smith sort of drifts away from the events. He's not on the boat decks dealing with passengers. The second officer, Lightoller, who was the highest-ranking officer to survive the ship, he claimed that the order for women and children first was, if it was given by the captain, he didn't hear it. He adopted it on his own in his sense of his actions during that process. But even Lightoller, when we get into the facts of it, there were women who worked as stewards on the ship that worked on taking care of rooms for guests in first and second and even third class. When they came to the lifeboats, Lightoller turned them away for upper class,
right.
Or first class passengers and second class passengers. So there was the Titanic. In a lot of ways, it represented a microcosm of society on both sides of the Atlantic, economic classes. It represented the modern technology. Everything was riding, in a sense, everything of the modern world and who the modern world thought it was riding on that ship.
Mm.
And it was being dealt with in untruthful terms.
Well, and I think what's interesting is in 2020 hindsight, we can look back at Titanic and we can be critical, right? Fact that there weren't enough lifeboats, the fact that they continued at full head into that iceberg field. You know, there's so many books and documentaries and movies about the Titanic. It's still a cultural phenomenon.
It's still so
but
popular.
What I find to be so fascinating about Shaw at that time as a contemporary is he was able to cut through all of that and all of the romanticism and all of the hysteria and all of the hands clutching at the heart and say, wait a minute,
yes.
The captain isn't as he seems. And I love the anecdotes about Duff Gordon, I believe.
Oh, yes.
A wealthy woman who got in a lifeboat. And, you know, stories and accounts said that she was in this full lifeboat, when in actuality, there were more men in that boat, and it was not even a full boat at all. And Shaw picked up on all these discrepancies and was able to kind of knit them together into compelling pieces you read today and say, wow, he really had some insight at the time. He wasn't blinded by any of this stuff.
Absolutely. And when Lady Duff Gordon's accounts they started as her own accounts of the survival, and they started to appear in newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic in April 20th, 6 days from the sinking of the ship. And she talks about being in a lifeboat, and it was herself, her assistant. Then there were two American passengers, and of course, Lady Duff Gordon's husband, and six crew members. And it was supposed to be the third to last lifeboat to leave the ship. And what we have is 12 people on this lifeboat. 10 are men, 2 are women, and yet this is all through the romanticizing of the notion of and the heroic claim of women and children first into these lifeboats. And here's a lifeboat that's going off with only, it's grotesquely underpopulated.
Mm-hmm.
This particular boat, now, to be fair, as she would refer to later on, it was a small boat. It was smaller than the main lifeboats on the ship. Which would had a capacity of 60 to 75, but the lifeboat she was on, which was lifeboat number 1, had a capacity of 40 people, and there were only 12 on it, and only 2 were women. And so this didn't really fit into this notion of the romantic call for women and children first. And Shaw was calling on that. And it wasn't that Shaw was necessarily criticizing the Duff Gordon's efforts to survive. He was very cognizant of that. But he was criticizing this romantic notion that we're going to all just blindly and accept this great idea of women and children first. If I could read just a small passage from Shaw when he starts to write about the Titanic on May 14th. A month after the ship had first hit the iceberg. And he
1912.
Starts, right, 1912, yes. And he starts off by saying, why is it that the effect of a sensational catastrophe on a modern nation is to cast it into transports, not of weeping, not of prayer, not of sympathy with the bereaved, nor congratulations of the rescued, not of poetic expression of the soul purified by pity and terror, but of a wild defiance of inexorable fate and an undeniable fact by an expression of outrageous romantic lying. And then Shaw went on to all these notions of what is the romantic formula that all the journalism seemed to be taking up with Titanic. And of course, Shaw knew by doing this and taking this angle, he was putting himself in a very, compromised position. Journalists were not doing this at that time. And he stepped forward to try to reach the truth. And in his view, only by knowing the facts and knowing what really happened can we begin to understand it and therefore hope and find a way to prevent such a catastrophe again.
And Shaw did this work and put himself out on a limb right as World War I was on the horizon. And that's where journalistically he would come to do some of his most important work. Let's talk about that in just a moment after a break. Stay with us. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. This is The Point. We're talking with author Nelson Richel about his new book, Bernard Shaw, W.T. Stead, and the New Journalism. As we went to break, we were starting to talk about World War I, where Shaw wrote some of his most important and controversial journalistic works. So set the scene. Britain seems inevitably headed toward war with Germany, and Shaw has some grave concerns.
Yes, he does. He sees that the foreign policy that the government was then pursuing through its foreign secretary, Sir Edward Grey, it was a diplomacy of secrecy. It was even the House of Commons was not apprised as to what Grey was doing, what treaties he had pursued. And in the last, from late 1905, when that government came into power and Grey was appointed foreign secretary, Grey had created an alliance with autocratic Russia, which Shaw found extremely upsetting and outrageous, even given that England at that time, through its parliamentary system and constitutional monarchy, saw itself as moving in the direction of democracy. And same with Republican France at that time. So here were two powerful democracies having an alliance with Tsarist Russia. Mm-hmm. And there was plenty of evidence at that time of political disappearances and so forth in the Tsarist empire. Right. And so there was a very questionable there. And so Shaw thought this alignment was outrageous. And he thought the proper alliance, the common sense alliance that was needed, was to form a triple relationship between France, Germany, and England. So if one attacked one of the others, the other would then join and attack the aggressor. And so he thought this way, these three powers could preserve peace. But what Shaw suspected, too, was that as the deeper and the longer that the arms race progressed, and certainly Titanic was part of that arms race, because naval architecture was a major part of it, which carried out in commercial shipping. But the deeper we got into it, Shaw was quite cognizant of the idea that the seduction of the war for those in power was too much. Mm-hmm. And the idea that we had this armament.
They wanted to use it.
They wanted to use it.
And I think also what's interesting at the same time, as British leaders are preparing the country to go to war, they curtail the press. They say,
oh, yes,
hey, you know, you're not going to get out of line and mm-hmm. You're not going to criticize us right now. We need to, you know, bind together as one nation and get ready for this event. And Shaw is extremely critical of that. He stands kind of away from the pack.
Yes, absolutely. As soon as it becomes at the very end of July 1914, it's fairly clear that the world is going to war, and certainly the European powers are, which would eventually draw America into it. And Shaw was very critical. The other journalists were talking about supporting the government. Grey was quoted in a newspaper saying, "We are monitoring the situation and our lines of communication with all the governments that are at play have been fully accessible." And you know, but without saying anything, without saying what they're going to do, and the English delayed making it known that they would fight with France if Germany declared war on France. There was a cabinet discussions on that front. The cabinet was not unified at that point, but for far as the public knew, England was delaying. Shaw thought if England had come right out and said that if Germany declares war on France, and which would have stemmed from France declaring war on Germany after Germany would declare war on Russia.
Domino effect.
Yes. England would join in. And Shaw thought that if Germany and Austria knew that the English were going to come in definitely, there might have been a different outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not have been quite as anxious to have, certainly would not have wanted to fight so many different fronts.
Well, and as we know, Shaw's viewpoints were not really heated at that time,
Britain
not. Entered the war. And I think what's interesting, too, is, again, the press at the time, and Shaw stands counter to them, there are calls for everyone to sign up and join the war effort. And Shaw is critical of this, not because at this point he doesn't want them to go to war, you mm-hmm. talk about in your book, but Because he doesn't see a good enough reason. He wants the leadership to give the country a reason that will sustain them through what he's perceiving to be a very long, and he was right, a long, drawn-out, very bloody war.
Yes, and with it, when the great casualties start to come in, and they're horrific casualties, even at the early stages of the war. And what Shaw, in many respects, did what Abraham Lincoln did in the American Civil War in this country, that once the war was, it was clear, it was getting bogged down, the casualties were horrific, far more gruesome and extensive than the public had ever could have possibly have fathomed when the war started. Lincoln knew that he had to make the war about something far more noble. This massive suffering had to have a purpose.
A meaning.
A meaning. And particularly, that would be the only way it could be brought to a satisfactory conclusion. And so he, of course, as we know, he goes to emancipation, the Emancipation Proclamation, and makes it suddenly then turns the war into a war specifically on slavery rather than states' rights and everything else.
Right.
And Shaw was very much of the same view, that the war had to be about something. And there was a lot of the idea of what was happening in the British press in the first 6 months of the war was the demonizing of Germany and blaming that the whole war, that everything was to be blamed with Germany, their aggression and so forth. But Shaw was very quick to point out that the militarists in England were the same militarists in Germany and the same in France and the same in Russia and Austria and so forth. And so Shaw saw that if this is going to be a war of military dominance, then that was only going to condemn the world to another war, another colossal war. And of course, on that front, he was absolutely correct. He thought the war had to be about something different. It had to be, in his view, to bring greater democracy, greater freedom to the world. And, we think of Shaw as a socialist, and he was, but the definition of the Shaw socialist was probably not what most of us would think or connect to socialism today. For Shaw, it meant full equality for all people. That meant wealth, gender, race, that everyone would be on the equal level. And he would carry that also to the notion of equal incomes. But even that issue, we hear a lot today about the difference and the great gaps between incomes in this country and in Europe and around the world. And that gap is growing. And this was something that Shaw spent a lot of time thinking about in 1914 as with the war. And he would argue, too, that if we had equal income, we would not have these decisions for war on along the notions of trade and so on. But regardless of that, Shaw was really thought the war had to be about something meaningful. It had to be about, if we're going to have this much suffering and death, it had to bring something into the world.
It strikes me a little in thinking about modern times in the climate and the way that we kind of handled things after the 9/11 attacks, where there was this quieting down, and even in the press for a little while, this kind of stepping back a little bit and unifying as a country after something terrible, of course. But I couldn't help but wonder, what would Shaw think of the way in which those events played out and how the United States in this case got itself stuck in a drawn-out war?
Yes, I think Shaw would have, of course, he would have been sympathetic to the suffering that followed 9/11, but he would have started to question immediately the government's response. Mm-hmm. We know now we go into Afghanistan, then that would lead into Iraq, and now we look back on it and we see that the rationale for going into Iraq at that time perhaps was not as sound as it should have been. So I would imagine that Shaw would have been at the forefront in criticizing that. I mean, do we have evidence that Iraq was involved with the 9/11 attacks or anything remotely connected to it?
Mm-hmm.
And Shaw would have gone in that route and would have called for rational thinking.
It's kind of a consistent message that he has throughout a lot of his writing, and especially in World War One, this is such an emotional event that it touches so many people. His views were not very popular, at least at first.
Yes. When the Defense of the Realm Act was enacted by England in early August 1914, which essentially put restrictions on the press, what the press could say, whether the press could criticize the government, and so on. Shaw did not let that stop him. But what did start to stop his journalism was his views were not being welcomed by editors. And C.P. Scott, for example, the Manchester Guardian, in September 1914, writes to Shaw on a piece that Shaw had submitted and said, well, while I may agree with you, this is not the time to divide. It is a time for unity. So we best not publish it. And Shaw, at that point, was already working on a monumental essay that he would call Common Sense About the War. And he would call in a number of favors to have this published. And it's about an 80,000-word essay.
Really is monumental in a lot of ways.
Yes, and he even referred to it to his sister as he was writing it, the monumental affair. So he too, was cognizant of that notion.
And he had a sense of his own place in history, I gather.
Absolutely. He had a sense of by that time, sure, he knew what he was doing. He knew that, and he would refer to that that his journalism at that point during the war was writing history. We have to know, we're going to have to know what really happened here, and we need that voice to come forward to really deal with the facts. He said, and for not just for the future, but also for the day when the war is going to be resolved, that we have to have a rational end to the war. And essentially what he warned the world not to do, and particularly England and France and the Allies, was to put the war debt on Germany, essentially crippling the German economy. And of course, we know the vacuum created by that.
They did exactly that and set the stage for World War II.
Absolutely.
And he warned against it.
Yeah.
At great risk to himself, too, in his career.
Yes.
I mean, he at this point, again, he is at the apex of his career. If he didn't want to, he could have just been comfortable as a playwright, but he felt compelled to keep weighing in.
Yeah, the easiest thing to have done for Shaw, and the safest, would to have been quiet and just let it ride out and concentrate perhaps on American productions of his plays or even English.
Make social commentary in his plays, which he often did. He often took events or concepts or themes or even people from what he had encountered as a journalist, and they pop up in his plays throughout his career.
Yes, absolutely. And they, for a good case in point, would have been his play Heartbreak House that he starts to write during the war. He holds it back till quite a few years after the war has ended. And there is a scene near the end of the play where characters are outside. It's during a German Zeppelin raid in England, and bombs are dropped. Two characters are killed, and other characters who had witnessed it and knew that these other characters had been killed, and they talk about how thrilling it was that the Zeppelins going above, dropping bombs, this sensational spectacle.
It was entertaining.
Of entertainment, of death, and that goes back to Stead in the 1880s with that. And that was always the danger with the shock journalism. It created a fascination with death, with murder, with violence, and we see that in our own world. We see that in films, popular films, popular television. The violence is played out. It should abhor us, but it really, if it did, we wouldn't have so much of it, for the sake of just having violence.
It hits a very deep part, I think, of the human psyche.
Yeah, and Shaw, after he wrote Common Sense About the War, and really took a lot of attacks on the way the British had led the country into the war, the way the British were executing the war. He saw a danger with Britain and Germany and France that with these modern armies, with these modern technology, they were still relying on 17th and 18th century practices of pulling their officers from the aristocracy. And Shaw saw most of these individuals as being idlers, that they were not fit for any real employment. In fact, a lot of them did not work before the war, and yet they were suddenly propelled into the military with military commands. Now, that's not to say there were not some fine officers, but more often than not, there were a lot of officers that were clearly not competent and not cognizant of machine guns on all sides. The notion of sending armies into marching and running into machine guns coming out of the trenches, it's just horrific.
And of course, something that's well known today, right? Looking back with that 2020 hindsight, but Shaw saw it at the time, which is notable.
Even Shaw knew it in 1894. He has it in his play, Arms and the Man. There is a recounting of a scene of machine guns. There's no bullets at that point, but there is a discussion that had they had the proper ammunition, the machine gun, this cavalry charge that raced into a machine gun, no one would have survived it. And so Shaw was, did have a forward thought of it. But once Common Sense About the War came out, it was heavily criticized, and most of it was led by Arthur Hamsworth, who was Lord Norcliffe, and he had owned a newspaper empire in England, including the Times and the Daily Mirror. And in the Mirror, Norcliffe editorialized and writes that Shaw tells us, and quoting from Norcliffe, at great length, that we are as much to blame for the war as Germany. And of course, that was one of Shaw's points. And the editorial concluded with, "Let us have the admirers of Mr. Shaw in Berlin rejoice. They now can revive his plays." And so that was
they called him a traitor.
Oh, yes, absolutely. He was known as a traitor. And yet, by February, March 1915, just a few months later, Harmsworth, or Norcliffe, in his papers, it would follow Shaw's example of criticizing the government. And this was particularly over the lack of shells, ammunition shells on the British front. And that would lead to the curtailing of Lord Kitchener's in running the military. And Shaw would write of this later on in a work he titled More Common Sense About the War. And he said, and I'm quote, "The incident was a striking example of the power of a democratic press in its legitimate use as the proper antidote to the official secrecy with which governments hide their misdeeds and shortcomings from the public." And Shaw had called on all journalists to have celebrated that notion. And he was absolutely right in that. That is what the free press should be, the antidote to governments trying to hide their misdeeds. And that's something, we're seeing now in our own times.
In many ways encapsulates rather neatly a lot of his legacy, the search for truth and the willingness to stand up and to continue to stand up. He faced a lot of criticism, and another person might have stood back and backed down, but he didn't.
No, he didn't. And, if we could, if I jumped back just for a moment in 1901, Shaw gave an interview to the Frank Harris in a publication called Candid Friend, where Shaw talked about his journalism at that time. And I think it really gets to his sense of how he worked as a journalist. And he wrote, I took extraordinary pains, all the pains I was capable of, to get to the bottom of everything I wrote about. There is an indescribable levity, not triviality, mind, but levity, something sprite-like about the final truth of the matter. And the exquisite levity communicates itself in the style of the writer who will face the labor of digging down to it. And that's, I think, really sums up a lot of Shaw's thinking of his journalism and his journalism in quite, very quite specifically. It was about getting to the truth. And the sensational shock journalism, the alternative facts, all of that for the sake of popularity, for the sake of political agendas, what have you. It was obscuring the truth, and Shaw was about getting to the truth.
Certainly a viewpoint with a lot of relevance today. Nelson Mitchell, author of Bernard Shaw, W.T. Stead and the New Journalism, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
You can find more information about the book on our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.